car after dropping the man off at the White Hotel. It was one of the few company jobs accorded colored teenagers in the South at that time, and was thought to be a good one. One day, he was straightening the man's office when he opened a drawer and saw something white folded inside. He pulled it out and unfurled the fabric. It was a white robe and hood. Trembling, he put it back in the drawer and had to reconsider everything he thought he knew about the man he had trusted and the world in which he lived. That night he went home and told his parents and his little sisters that he was leaving Georgia for Detroit, one of the receiving stations for people from that part of the South. He had made his decision, was shocked into it, really. He would get a job at Chrysler, like a cousin of theirs. He was joining the Great Migration for the most personal and profound of reasons, and without knowing it, planted a seed in my mother's imagination, knowing as she did why her big brother had fled. Several seeds were planted, too, in Ida Mae, Lil George, and Pershing. Ida Mae heard about this one or that one going north to freedom after a lynching or a raw deal at settlement. Her big brothers, Sam and Cleve, had fled to Toledo. Her big sister Irene was talking about going to Milwaukee, and as Ida Mae came of age, she saw the cloche hats and unobtainable finery of city living in the pages of the Sears Roebuck catalog out of Chicago. Lil George watched the Bly brothers, Babe and Reuben, older boys who'd gone north to New York, come back to Eustis in their zoot suits and fedoras. They talked about all the money they were making, building the 9W highway up in Jersey, about the skyscrapers and streetlights, the dance halls in Harlem, the parties in Corona, and the boulevards paved where the colored people lived. "We used to sit up all night," George remembered, "and listen to Babe and M.B. and Reuben and Freeman and all of them talking about New York. And I said, 'Boy, that sounds just like heaven. I want to see some of that. New York. I'm sure going to New York soon as I get big enough.' And in Monroe, Louisiana, if Mantan Moreland passed through town, there was a stir in the pews and talk in the pool hall. Everyone wanted to sit down with the native son who had made it to Hollywood, even if it was only as a shuffling sidekick in the movies. Pershing saw the parade of people from the North and the movie scenes at the Paramount of life beyond Louisiana and began dreaming of escape, too. When he was still small enough to fit in the crawl spaces of the houses on cinder block stilts, he played pretend with a girl down the street named Clara Poe. They peeked out from under the floor joists and waited for a car to rumble down Louise Ann Avenue and fought over whose it was. "It's my car. No, it's my car." Then they pretended they were in the car, leaving. Clara always said she was going to Chicago, where her uncles were. But no matter how many times Clara said Chicago, Pershing said he was going to California. He didn't have any family there. All he knew was that one day, somehow, whenever he got big and whatever it took, he was going. A burdensome labor. This land is first and foremost his handiwork. Wherever one looks in this land, whatever one sees that is the work of man, was erected by the toiling, straining bodies of blacks. David L. Cohn, God Shakes Creation. But the Egyptians mistreated and oppressed us, assigning us a burdensome labor. Deuteronomy, chapter 26, verse 6. Chickasaw County, Mississippi, 1929. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. Ida Mae's new husband took her to live in a little wood cabin on Ed Pearson's plantation on a clearing past the Natchez Trace. Ida Mae was 16. In the morning, the sun poked at them through the gaps in the roof. At night, they could see the stars through the ceiling cracks over their bed. It just about rained inside as much as out. They set about working cotton for Mr. Ed. All around them, the land was in a state of being cotton or becoming cotton, brown and rutted for planting. Green shoots willed into rows of coddled bushes until the land was white out to the tree line. Every so often, A wood cabin broke the clearing, raw and thrown together, built uneasily on a footprint of land that was a fraction of what was devoted to the field. The people who lived in the cabins gave the best hours of their days to cotton, working until the sun went behind the trees and they couldn't see their hands anymore. Early morning, the mist rose over the fields and made a halo on the surface of the earth. Ida May's new husband and the sharecroppers working other sections of Pearson's land tried to pick as much as they could before the sun got high. Ed Monroe Pearson was a decent boss man, as decent as could be expected from a planter in Mississippi in the 1920s. He presided over the lives of some dozen families who grew his crops, as Ida May would recall, and he took half of whatever they produced, whether it was cotton or turkeys or hogs. At the end of the season, he deducted the debts he said they owed. Cottonseed, fertilizer, implements, ginning fees, cornmeal, salt pork. The furnish, as it was called, of their half of the harvest. Money rarely changed hands between planter and sharecropper, as the entire system was built on credit. The sharecroppers owed the planters owed the merchants owed the banks, and the banks were often beholden to some business concern in the north, where most of the real money was in the first place. Unlike some planters, Mr. Ed actually gave George and Ida May a few dollars when settling time came at the end of the harvest. Although they never knew whether they would get anything, or how much it might be, or if it was actually what they were due. Nor could they complain if it wasn't. Ed Pearson was about the best boss man a colored sharecropper could hope for. But he was a ranking member of the dominant caste and felt it within his right to involve himself in the private affairs of his serfs. He came through the field on his horse one day and saw George bent over picking through the rows. George and Ida May had been out for hours, and the sun had cooked their backs. Ida May had no gift for picking like her new husband did, and had fallen farther and farther behind, stooping from the weight of the sack. George had called out to her, but she was too far back and too beat from the sun to catch up. After a few dozen pounds, her knees gave way. She saw a clear path up ahead, and dropped onto her sack, collapsed in the dirt aisle between the cotton rows. Mr. Ed rode up to George and questioned him about it. "Your wife don't do nothing, do she, but sit down," Mr. Ed said to George. George would have liked to have said it was his business and not Mr. Ed's, but colored men could not say such things to a white man in Mississippi and get away with it in 1929. When Mr. Ed was gone, George went back to Ida May. "See, can't you try and do a little bit better," George said, caught between the two of them. She said she would try, but there was no use pretending. She was not going to be of much help in the field. She had never been able to pick 100 pounds. 100 was the magic number. It was the benchmark for payment when day pickers took to the field. 50 cents for 100 pounds of cotton in the 1920s, the gold standard of cotton picking. It was like picking 100 pounds of feathers, 100 pounds of lint dust. It was one of the most back-breaking forms of stoop labor ever known, wrote the historian Donald Hawley. It took some 70 bulls to make a single pound of cotton, which meant Ida May would have to pick 7,000 bulls to reach 100 pounds. It meant reaching past the branches into the cotton flower and pulling a soft lock of cotton the size of a walnut out of its pod, doing this 7,000 times, and turning around and doing the same thing the next day and the day after that. The hands got cramped from the repetitive motion of picking, the fingers fairly locked in place and calloused from the pricks of the barbed, 5-pointed cockle burrs that cupped each precious bowl. The work was not so much hazardous as it was mind-numbing and endless, requiring them to pick from the moment the sun peeked over the tree line to the moment it fell behind the horizon and they could no longer see. After 10 or 12 hours, the pickers could barely stand up straight for all the stooping. Ida May had watched people do it all her life and knew how it was done. But when it came time to actually go out and pick it, she would look up and see everybody else far down the row. At weighing time, she would empty her sack on the scale and never get three digits. Above her was an entire economy she could not see, but which ruled her days and determined the contours of her life. There were bankers, planters, merchants, warehouse clerks, fertilizer wholesalers, seed sellers, plow makers, mule dealers, gin owners. A good crop and a high price made not much improvement to the material discomforts of Ida May's existence, but meant a planter's wife could begin to dream of a new parlor carpet and a piano, and a salesman of farm implements could be lavish with more expensive cigars than he smoked last year. On Wall Street, there were futures and commodities traders wagering on what the cotton she had yet to pick might go for next October. There were businessmen in Chicago needing Oxford shirts, socialites in New York and Philadelphia wanting lace curtains and organdy evening gowns. Closer to home, closer than one dared to contemplate, there were Klansmen needing their white cotton robes and hoods. In the half-light of morning, when the mist hung low and the dew was thick on the boles, the pickers set out to the field as their slave foreparents had done year in and year out for two centuries. The first horn was blown an hour before daylight as a summons for work hands to rise. Each one looked out across the field to infinity. The quarry was spread over acres and rows far from the starting plant, and they could not see the end of what they were expected to pick. On large fields during the height of the season, which began in August in South Texas and moved eastward, reaching the Carolinas by early fall, the star pickers sped like fan blades through the cotton, a blur of fingers and bowls, arms and torsos, switching from the left row to the right, picking on both sides of them and tossing the cotton like feathers into their sack. The sacks were strapped over their shoulders and dragged in the dirt behind them like an extra limb, the sacks weighing as much as a human adult by the end of the day and making them stoop all the more. They picked until they were hypnotized by the picking. By midday, the fast ones and the slow ones were far from the center, the stars way up ahead and not looking back, the slow ones trailing behind, the most watchful of everyone's placement. The field was flat and unbroken by trees, and there was no escape from the 100-degree heat. The sun bore down on them through the head rags and the Panama hats and made the cotton field shimmer like the ocean. Pickers thought they saw things like people who had died and come back, and waved a handkerchief in the air to call the water boy from under a shade tree. He was usually a picker's child, the one designated to fetch the bucket of well water when they needed it, half the water splashing out of the bucket and onto the ground as the water boy trudged down the rows. Throughout the cotton kingdom, the act of picking cotton was the same. But in the hills, the cotton was sparser and shorter, not thick and shoulder-high like cotton in the Delta. It was harder to get 100, much less more. You had to pick a wider field and stoop to pick the lowest bolls to reach the same benchmark. There were ways to make life easier or harder for yourself when it came to picking cotton. Experienced pickers knew to pick in a rapid flowing motion, trance-like and efficient. The strongest of the men like George, could pick two or three times their weight in cotton. 400 pounds gave a man bragging rights in anybody's field. A woman could hold her head up if she picked 100. It was a mean enough world that people got desperate. For one thing, for day pickers, there was the money. For another, there was their pride. And then there was the fact that they did not want to be there in the first place. Some people collected rocks, hid them in their pockets, and threw them into their sack at weighing time to make a heavier load. Some people picked the stalk and all to add extra weight. Some were the first out in the morning, picking early while the dew was on the bud, which meant much of the weight was water. It was a trick they could get away with, unless the planter set the cotton out in the sun to dry it out, which some did. When those who were so inclined didn't outright lard their sacks, they helped themselves to the peaches and berries on the edges of the boss's cotton and gave themselves a raise for breaking their backs in the field. Many years later, the people would stand up to water hoses and sheriff's dogs to be treated as equal. But for now, the people resisted in silent, everyday rebellions that would build up to a storm at mid-century. Rocks stuffed into cotton sacks in Mississippi at weighing time. The colored-only signs pulled from the seat backs of public buses and converted into dartboards in dorm rooms in Georgia. Teenagers sneaking into coffee shops and swiveling on the soda fountain stools forbidden to colored people in Florida, and then running out as fast as they'd come in before anybody could catch them. Each one fought in isolation and unbeknownst to the others long before the marches and boycotts that were decades away. Sometime in the 1930s, a crew of pickers had been assembled to harvest a wide field of cotton near Brookhaven, Mississippi, some 200 miles south of Chickasaw County, where Ida May lived. On the crew was a big man who had just gotten out of Parchman Prison. Word spread through the field that the man had killed somebody, but no one knew for sure. It was clear from the start that the man could pick. He was used to picking with a gun to his back. He could pick like a machine when he got paid for it. People could hardly pick for watching the man. One of the slower pickers was a teenager who figured if he could just stick behind the prisoner, he could make more money for himself. So he got behind him and did what he did, or tried to, anyway. The prisoner did not speak. He just picked until he was a faint figure in the distance. The slow picker fell behind, and when dusk approached, he knew from his sack that he was underweight. The other pickers headed to the scales, but the slow picker dragged his sack behind a tree. He looked to his left and to his right, and in front of him to see that no one was watching. Then he pulled down his coveralls. He opened the sack that represented a day's worth of work and his bent back, and the pennies he would get for this bent back, because he knew it did not amount to 100 pounds. That was when he positioned the sack just so, and relieved himself in the boss man's cotton for spite and the extra dime, because he didn't like having to pick cotton anyway. Ida May grew up isolated in the hills and never heard about these things until it was too late to do her any good. So she and her husband worked the piece of Pearson land apportioned to them with duty and resignation. She herself could not afford a dress made out of the cotton that ruled their days. What she wore was pieced together from flour sacks that she boiled for hours until the flour company's name finally faded away. Burlap scratching her skin, and the sun hunting her down. She dragged a sack behind her and plucked and picked, not figuring she was clothing a small piece of the world, and never giving much thought to where the contents would land. All around her, in raw cabins leaning in different corners of the plantation, were offshoots of her husband's family, half-brothers, whole sisters, uncles, cousins, and their wives and husbands and children. A nephew, Robert Pulliam, whom they called Saint, helped them pick cotton sometimes. A cousin named Joe Lee was willing to help, but nobody much wanted him around because he was known for taking things that weren't his. A neighbor named Addie B. raised turkeys on the half for Mr. Ed and fretted over them when they went roosting in the woods. George's brother Willie was the patriarch, because he was the oldest of them all. Ida May tried to learn who all these people were, and set about trying to become a wife. Willie's daughter, Callie May, showed her how to roll dough and make blackberry cobbler and tomato pie. They went picking blackberries on the running vine up and down the ditch bank to bake their cobblers with. George liked his greens with fatback or hog maws, and she learned how to cook them like he liked. She got up early and chopped wood as well as a man for the cooking fire. She put the meat on, and before the meat was brown and near ready to fall off the bone, she stuffed the greens in the pot, and they cooked down and swam in pot liquor so good it made you want to swallow your tongue, as they used to say in their highest compliment to a cook. George would never just come out and say he liked it. He just ate, and that's how she knew he did. Saturday was for washing and ironing. She hauled water in from the well and washed their clothes in the iron kettle. Sunday was for church. The rest of the time, she was out in the field beside George, hoeing or chopping or picking cotton around the army worms that nested in the leaves. It took 1,400 pounds to make a bale, and George needed to make a bale every 2 or 3 days in the picking season. Mr. Ed took half. "You know he comes first," Ida May would say years later. They saved a little piece of land behind the house to plant corn and collards and peanuts and sweet potatoes. George hauled Ida May out to plant and till their little garden in the off hours, but Ida May didn't much want to be out there. They had been working all day and were planting the last of the corn. George dug a trough in the earth and told her to come behind him and scatter the kernels in the trench he made, which she did until she got tired of it. She had a pail full of seeds left. She threw the whole pail of kernels into the hole he dug and told him she was just fresh out of seeds. In the fall, the corn came up. It was full and dense in one spot of land, the corn stalks elbowing one another in the row. George and Ida May ate well that season. George didn't have much to fuss about. There were things she was good at and things she was not so good at, and she saved herself a lot of aggravation by knowing the difference between the two. She was good at raising chickens, and she kept one in a coop to press into service whenever she needed it. "If I wanted it for breakfast, I'd kill it in the morning," she said. "I'd go out there, wring the neck off, have my hot water scalding, cut 'em up and fry 'em for breakfast." Nothing scared her, like that morning at picking time when George had already left for the field. She lay in bed and heard a rattling in the kitchen. "I know ain't nobody in their kitchen," she told herself, rising to see what it was. A speckler, a snake as long as a broom handle, had slithered over the edge of a bucket and was helping itself to the drinking water she had hauled in from the well. She backed out of the door and got the pitchfork and stuck it through him. She held up the pitchfork with the snake dangling from it and dropped it into the dirt yard. Then she took a stick and beat it until it stopped making S's with its body. The snake was full of guinea eggs it had swallowed from the guinea nest, and it hadn't had a chance to wrap itself around a tree to break the eggs in it yet. The eggs broke when she killed it. She told George about it when he dragged in from the field. He didn't praise her for her bravery or say much of anything. "I've been seeing him all day," was all he said. It was getting to be the 1930s. It was a herding time, and the farm people almost couldn't give the cotton away. The value of what they harvested, the worth of their hard labor and the measure of their days, plummeted after the crash of 1929. A bale of cotton had gone for nearly 30 cents in the mid-1920s, and for nearly 17 cents in the late 1920s. By 1931, the planters couldn't get 6 cents for the same bale of cotton. The people in New York and Boston were not ordering up new seersucker suits and cotton pillowcases like they did just a few years before. The cotton ripened in the bud, but there was nobody to buy it. So the boss men went without new Model T Fords. The sharecroppers went without shoes. Ida May fed the chickens and worked the field barefoot. She watched George haul in cotton with no assurance of what, if anything, the planter might give him for it, and tried not to worry her mind over what she could not fix. Before long, she started feeling full around her belly. She didn't think much of it. She went about her chores and rode horseback when she went to visit her kin people. No horse was fast enough for Ida May, and she raced now like she always did. It wasn't good for the life that was growing inside her, and she miscarried riding those horses before she knew she was expecting. Her belly got full again, and she didn't ride horses this time. She hated waddling into church with her flour sack dress pulling tight across the front and her belly sticking out. She was in the field when the thunder came. It started as a light knocking deep inside her. She ran into the house, and the thunder got violent. It shot to the top of the ceiling and hurled itself back into her. She got up and started walking, walking in a circle around the bed. The midwife came and watched her rock from foot to foot. "I could see the pain coming down on the top of the house and keep coming," she said. "The men don't know what the women go through," was what she was thinking. "Don't feel the stab of lightning inside." "Ought to be so they could," Ida May said. She stopped her pacing and squatted beside the bed. She was on her knees. The life force reached out of her and into the light. It was a girl. Ida May never wanted a girl. She was still thinking like a tomboy wanting to climb a tree. The baby had big eyes and a brown, narrow face like her husband's. They named her Velma. In time, Ida May took to her and held her close. Within a year or so, she started feeling full again. It was another girl. They named her Elma, but called her Baby Sis. Ida May took them to the field with her when it was time to plant. She set them both down in the shade of a plum tree. It got too hot for them out in the field. They were toddlers now. Ida May told them to sit still, and then took her place behind her husband at the turn row. The sun bore down on Ida May and George, and soon they heard crying near the plum tree. It was Velma wailing, and Baby Sis lying sick with half-eaten plums beside her. Velma had reached up and gotten her some, and Baby Sis ate them and got the flux, as the country people called whatever stomach ailment, poison, or virus had got into the baby. It was a perilous world in the early 1930s, even without Jim Crow. Dysentery, typhus, malaria all thrived in the backwoods of the Deep South before penicillin or common vaccines were invented. There were no doctors nearby, and by the time they got Baby Sis to one, it was too late. They buried her in a little box at the church cemetery near Buny. Ida May told herself that day that she would never leave a child of hers alone again. In September of 1935, she finally got the boy she wanted. He had the brown, narrow face of her husband. When it came time to name him, a neighbor girl stepped forward. The girl looked after Velma when Ida May was in the field and took care of a little white boy in town when she was summoned to do so. His name was James Walter. George and Ida May had never laid eyes on the boy, but they named their son after him and hoped maybe good fortune would rain down on their son, like it seemed to fall on the white people. Not long after he had begun walking, something took over little James. He began rearing back and shaking all of a sudden. It could happen any time, and it so worried Ida May that she went looking for advice. "Next time he has a seizure," a neighbor lady told her, "whatever he got on, pull it off." George had managed to scrape together a pair of shoes and socks and pants for his only son, and was still paying on them. On a Sunday after church, when George was out in the field somewhere, little James had a shaking fit. Ida May pulled off his shoes and tore off his socks as the neighbor lady told her to do. Off came his little shirt and pants. She made a wood fire and held little James tight as she threw his clothes into the flames. George got home and she gave him the good news that she had cured little James. But that's not what stood out in George's mind. "What you doing burning up his shoes?" George asked her. George didn't have a decent pair himself. Reason can't explain it, except that maybe little James outgrew whatever afflicted him, or maybe it wasn't really seizures in the scientific sense of the word, or maybe her belief that she had exercised the thing actually killed it. In any case, whatever James had, it never came back after she burned his clothes to cinders. A new year rang in. It was 1937. It looked to be no better than the year before. They were calling it the Depression now. People took to begging and scraping to eat. A man down the road started stealing hogs to sell and eat as his own. He was white and a friend, so to speak, to George. He rounded up somebody's hogs one day and came by George and Ida Mays to get George to help skin them. George didn't want to get blamed for somebody else's misdeeds. He could get killed for stealing a white man's hogs. He told the man to do it himself. The man didn't like hearing no. George and the man argued, and the man stormed off. "I'll be back," he said. "I'm a fix you." Chickasaw County had a sheriff, but calling him would have never crossed George's mind. No sheriff would take a colored man's side against a white man, no matter who was right. George called out to Ida May. "Ida May, you take the kids and go on in the house," he said. "I'm gonna sit right here till they come back." He sat on the porch, waiting with his shotgun on his knee. He looked out for an open-bed truck trailing dust in the road, or a car packed with men looking for trouble. Ida May crouched down and tried to still little James and Velma. George waited and waited, but they never came. "The next day or two," Ida May said. "Him and George back friends again, I reckon, getting the hogs." People learned to want less and live with whatever they had. The bossmen said there was little to nothing to give at settlement time. They told the day pickers they wouldn't be needing them. The cast-off croppers and field hands moved from place to place. They walked to the next farm up the road to see if they could use an extra hand, and to the relatives who might make a place for them in their cabin. Mr. Ed kept George and Ida May on. They were good workers, Ida May's picking notwithstanding, and he was an optimist. By now there were 5 people in their little sharecropper cabin. Besides them and Velma and James, they had taken in a boarder, so to speak. It was George's sister, Indiana. She helped with the picking of crops and the raising of turkeys, and she slept by the door in the front room. In the spring, when George and Ida May planted cotton and prayed for rain, the turkey hen laid her eggs. "She'd sit there and sit there," Ida May said. "Just sit there about 3 or 4 weeks. She'd get up, shake herself off, and go get her some water, dust water all over her, and do round and all, take a bath, I reckon what it was. She'd be settin' while we planted cotton." By the time the cotton was in the ground, the chicks poked out of their shells and required Ida May's attention. Ida May and Addie B. and other women on the Pearson plantation scooped up the chicks and tended them for Mr. Ed. He would be coming back just before Thanksgiving to take half of however many turkeys each woman managed to raise. Ida May pulled off the beak crust that they came into the world with and crushed corn for them to eat because they were too little to eat feed corn. The hawks circled overhead, waiting for her to leave, ready to swoop down and pick off a baby chick and fly back into the air before you knew it. Ida May didn't worry about the hawks. She knew the hens moved in a flock and didn't leave their babies like humans do. "You know a hen will take up for her chickens more so than people will take up for one another," Ida May said. "Whenever a old hawk would come along, you heard talk how a hawk will hover and all the chicks run under her wing. She hugs them and she sticks up for them and keep a funny noise, and you knew that hawk was somewhere around." She trusted God and nature more than any man and learned to be a better person watching the lower creatures of the earth. "The ant see a crumb, he can't carry it himself," Ida May said. "Don't you know another ant will come and help him? They better than people." Addie B. and the other women fretted over their turkeys, worried when they went off and when they took forever coming back because Mr. Ed was going to want his turkeys soon. Ida May let her turkeys run free and pick after bugs and ants and twigs in the dirt. They went exploring out in the woods and roosted wherever they pleased. And when they came back, she threw corn at their feet. The turkeys grew big and plump as September approached, and the land was turning white with cotton. Eustis, Florida, 1939. George Swanson Starling. A flatbed truck creaked down a highway through rattlesnake scrub and okra growing wild in the field. George Starling should not have been on that truck. He should have been in a college classroom up in Tallahassee. But his father said he'd had enough schooling, and schools nearby did not allow colored students. So little George went and got himself a wife out of spite and love, too, and had to feed her now, and so was sitting on a flatbed truck en route to the groves instead of in the library stacks at a college in the state capital. The truck was on its way between the groves on a chill morning at picking season. It was hauling men to pick fruit for fresh juice and frozen concentrate, for gift boxes of Temple oranges and ruby grapefruit, and the perfect balls of citrus stacked high on grocery shelves for people in New York to pick through. The owners of the groves rode their dogs in the covered front seats, safe from the wind. The pickers rode on the flatbed truck with the frost cutting their faces. 20 or 30 men hunched on the open barge, their legs dangling over the sides of it, and a stack of ladders tied loose along the rim. George sat pinned between the regular pickers, who were missing teeth and taking liberties with the language, and knew more about picking than he ever cared to know. They got a kick out of bouncing over potholes grove to grove next to the college boy. They looked to be the smart ones now. Hadn't had to squint over any textbooks or waste time in somebody's high school. And here they were carrying a bushel sack in the same flatbed truck as little George. Back when he was still in school and picking only during semester break, they started calling him schoolboy.
Schoolboy, one of them said. I don't know what you going to school for. You right out here with us. I ain't went so far as the sixth grade, and I can pick more fruit in 1 hour than you pick all day. You ain't had to go no 12th grade to learn how to do this.
Yeah, you right, George said. But the difference between you and me is I can leave from out here and you can't. When the opportunity presents itself, I can leave.
That was easy to say when he was back and forth to Tallahassee, calling himself a freshman and then a sophomore, and looking like he could do anything in the world. Now he was picking because he had to. No different from them. He told himself that this picking situation was a temporary setback, and kept himself busy doing whatever came up. Some days the high school had him substitute for a sick teacher. He had more education than most colored people in town anyway. He sold insurance on the side to the colored people out in the woods. But the groves were all there was most days, and he climbed the flatbed like every other colored citizen who could use the money, which was just about all of them at one time or another. Fruit was the currency of Central Florida. The land was given over to citrus trees, groves of them, spanning the low hills from Eustis up to Ocala and down to Orlando. Tourism hadn't yet bloomed the way it would decades later in Central Florida, and Eustis, Ocala, and even Orlando were just places to pass through on the way to Miami. Each year in the late 30s and early 40s, some 2 million tons of oranges and grapefruit were coming out of the state, most of it from the region where George lived. The people who picked the fruit and the big owners of the groves were often at odds with each other, one side poor, one side landed, one needing more money than the other was willing to give. But they agreed on one thing. They wanted the trees heavy with oranges, and the people of the north flush and hungry, because then there would be work enough for everyone. So they pampered the trees like infants. When a hard freeze afflicted the groves, the people burned logs and rubber tires and lit the oil heaters to keep the orange trees warm. They prayed for a miracle like the one at a grove they called Old Natural. A big freeze had settled in back in 1895, and most of the other groves looked as if they'd been set on fire after it left. But all naturals survived the big freeze, and its orange trees came back on their own. Lake County held a high place in the citrus belt, and once was the orange capital of the world. But little George never took it that seriously, and never got but so good at picking. He could never claim to have picked the most bushels in the least amount of time. It was piecework, and the winners of the race were not necessarily the quickest minds, but the fastest hands. George had a quick mind. In the late fall, a crowd gathered before the sun came up, when the fog hung close to the earth. The people stood watching at the corner of Bates and Palmetto and in front of the pool hall over in Easttown, near Egypt. They waited in the wet dark for the flatbed truck to roll up. The foreman climbed down and picked out the best pickers for his crew. The foremen were the middlemen between the packing houses and the pickers, and both sides might have cause to distrust them now and then. They chose the pickers and oversaw the picking, and each had their own way of supervising. It might be Oscar Lipscomb, or Uncle John Fashaw, or a man they called Mr. Pat, choosing his pickers for the season. George hoped to get on the Bly Brothers' crew. They were 10 years older than he was. They knew their way around the juke joints and the raccoon woods around Eustace. One of them was named Arnett, but they called him Whisper, because he had his throat cut, and could speak no louder than that. The other brother, Reuben, towered over the tallest of men. He had a stone face, a long series of wives, and had seen just about everything. When he was a little boy, an uncle told him to come help him with an errand. The two of them rode out into the woods and came to a stop at a tree. A colored man was hanging dead from a limb. The uncle needed Reuben's help cutting the rope and getting the limp, lynched body down. Reuben was 10 years old. He would never forget that. When Reuben got big, he fled to New York, worked at a tombstone factory in Brooklyn, on the 9W highway through Kingston up into Albany. He worked crushing tomatoes at a ketchup factory, and had seen so many of the unmentionable things that got mangled into the ketchup that he never ate ketchup again. Now he was back in Eustace, working as a foreman in the groves. He looked straight at you and through you, and had a way of making women forget their husbands when they saw him. It was a buyer's market in the picking world. There were always plenty more people who wanted to pick than there was room or need for in the groves. The lucky ones loaded onto the truck, their legs dangling from the rim of the flatbed. At the grove, they each picked a number out of a hat and went to the row with that number. They got paid by how many boxes of fruit they picked by sunset, and had to keep up with little tickets to prove what they had picked. If the row was thick with fruit, it would be a good day. They could stand at the underskirt and fill a 2-bushel box. If it was sparse, they had to climb into 2 or 3 trees to get that much. It tempted good people to try to out-trick one another. You looked for a way out. You learned to watch everybody and the rows coming up. The rule was that when you finished yours, you moved in order to the next row available. If it was a dud row, like the one you were working, you did your best to avoid it. "If that next row is a bad row," George said, "and you own a bad row, and here's somebody else by you own a bad row, you lag back. You keep watching them. You let them get through first ahead of you, so they can get that bad row. Then you hurry up and get through." If the next one up was thick with fruit and you own a bad row, you run through it, George said. "But you be sure they done moved over before you leave your row. You get cagey. It's little tricks in all this." Some men could pick 100 boxes a day. They called them high rollers. George never managed more than 65 or 70. He never cared enough about it to get proficient. They set the ladders in the tree, ladders 16 and 20 feet high, sometimes spliced like extension cords and leaning 40 feet up, a full 4 stories along the spine of the tree. They had to set them so the ladder wouldn't kick when they reached the top and wouldn't split the tree in two, which was liable to happen with a ladder set in the fork of a young bud. They learned to plant their ladders deep in the soil. The trees were wet from the rain, and George and the pickers had to balance themselves on the slick limbs of the old seedlings. They disappeared into the branches with a bushel sack on their shoulders and a clipper in their hand, and only came down when the sack was full and their shoulders ached, and they were sick from the sight of fruit. Tangerines, tangelos, temple oranges, navel oranges, Valencia oranges, seeded grapefruit, seedless grapefruit, red navels, ruby reds, lemons, and kumquats. If he had to pick, which he did, George would rather pick grapefruit, because they filled a box quicker. But the packing houses knew that, too. So they paid less for grapefruit than just about anything else. Up and down the ladders they went, working top to bottom, snipping fruit and filling boxes. Sometimes they heard a voice cry out way down the grove. A picker had come across a wasp nest and pulled at it instead of an orange. Every now and then they heard a thud and then a cry. A limb had snapped. Somebody fell out of a tree, broke an arm or leg or neck. George climbed the high limbs of four or five grown seedlings one morning and was climbing deep into the next. The foreman that day was an old colored man named Deacon John Fashaw. They called him Uncle John. George knew him from Gethsemane Baptist Church. The deacon oversaw the harvest of some of the groves at the Eichelberger Packing Company. He called George out of the tree in the middle of the grove.
"Number 14," he yelled.
Deacon Fashaw presided over his pickers with a suckle from an orange tree. It looked like a switch a mother whipped her children with. He called George over to him with the suckle in his hand.
"Now, number 14,
the deacon said, looking up into the limbs at George.
"Yes, sir."
"Come down here. Bring your ladder."
"Dog, what Uncle John want?" George said under his breath, and then out loud.
"I'll be there, Uncle John."
If he didn't move fast, next thing he'd know, Deacon Fashaw would be there shaking his ladder from under the tree.
"Come down, young man, come down."
George climbed down, and Deacon Fashaw swooshed the switch at him. Anybody else and George would have had him on the ground, but it was Deacon Fashaw, and the men respected his position too much to fight him.
"Now you bring your ladder back here." "I told you to bring your ladder back here."
George ran back to get the ladder and followed Deacon Fashaw back to the first tree he had picked.
"Now you see that orange up there in the top of the tree?"
"Yeah, Uncle John."
"Well, you know they want that orange in New York, and you done left it up there in that tree, and I don't like it. And Mr. Eichelberger don't like it. Mr. Eichelberger don't like it, and I ain't gonna have it. Now you put that ladder back in that tree, and you go right on up there and pick that orange right now."
Deacon Fashaw stood and watched George position his ladder and climb into the tree for that one orange as the other pickers peered through the branches. It was all part of Uncle John's plan. "He lets you get four or five trees away, so you have to drag that back," George said. "You probably done lost five or six boxes while you doing that. You do that two or three times, you soon get the message that I'm going to be sure I clean my tree before I leave it. I mean clean it." They moved from grove to grove in a single day. The flatbed truck rumbled down a highway past the bean fields and the turpentine stills. Midday, they finished one grove and were moving to the next. The truck reached an intersection and swung a hard left. The ladders broke from their lashes and shifted under the men. The loose ladders pushed the men off the open bed of the truck and onto the rough surface of the highway as if they'd been shot from a gun. George felt himself thrown to the gravel. His heels nearly hit his back, and he tried to break the fall with his elbow and knee. Half the workers were on the ground. Some had fallen onto their heads and were lying unconscious. A man named Nathan Bailey was never able to work again. He got $200 for his injuries after the men petitioned the packing company for help. George got $12.48 for his swollen knee and elbow, which he would remember for as long as he lived. They sent him two payments of $6.24 each. Most of the men took it and were grateful. George wasn't. The work was hard, and now it was dangerous. "You're not getting anything to begin with, you know, at the best," he said. George had some schooling, and the old men who teased him for it put their pride in their sack when they thought the packing house was cheating them.
"Schoolboy, look here," the man said. "Tell me how much I got for my work. Here my envelope."
George took it and looked at it and turned to the man.
"How many boxes of oranges did you pick?" George asked. "How many boxes of tangerines did you pick? How many boxes of grapefruit?"
The man told him what he thought he had picked, and George did the math.
"No, you $3 short. They done cheated you out of $3 somewhere, because if you picked the number of boxes you say you picked, you didn't get paid for all of it."
2 or 3 days' pay had disappeared. It was hard to keep up. Each kind of fruit paid a different rate. 4 cents a box for grapefruit one day, 10 cents a box for tangerines the next, 6 cents a box for oranges. If they didn't know how much they picked of each kind of fruit, or lost the little ticket that said what they had picked, or if the foreman added the numbers on the ticket wrong, whether on purpose or by accident, the pickers didn't get what little they were due. Sometimes they would tell you that they pay in one thing, and when you get your pay, you got less, George said. And if you couldn't figure, you didn't know the difference. They were very good at that. They promise you 4 cents for a box of grapefruit, and you get 2 cents. The pickers took whatever they got. Some asked about the difference, but didn't dare press it. Some wrote it off, blamed themselves, said they must have been the ones who'd lost their ticket. There was no point in protesting. There wasn't enough work as it was. It was the Depression. And for every man waiting at the corner of Bates and Palmetto in the black, wet morning at picking time, hoping to board a truck to the Groves, there were 10 more out there hoping he would miss it. Monroe, Louisiana, 1935. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. Pershing was 16 and making his first trip out of Monroe on his own on a bus ticket his brother Madison had given him for graduation. Pershing had just finished the 11th grade, which was as far as you could go if you were colored in Louisiana, and he was beside himself with anticipation. The sign on the front of the bus said St. Louis, and Pershing climbed on board with his suitcase in his hand and his back propped straight as if he were stepping onto the Queen Mary and going to France. He dusted the folds of his tweed suit and headed down the central aisle of the bus in search of a seat. The bus was not going to take him to the big north of southern dreams, but to a modest city in a border state where his brother was serving out his medical residency and well enough out of the south. He scanned the aisle to find a place for himself. His eye caught the wooden shingle with the metal prongs on the bottom, the shingle that said colored on one side and white on the other. It was set into holes at the top of a seat back toward the latter half of the bus. He didn't like seeing it, but he knew to expect it. He took a seat behind the wooden shingle and looked out the window at the view. Those white and colored shingles were as much a part of the southern landscape as cotton growing in the field. Each state and city had a different requirement or custom to signal how the races were to be separated, and to what extent the races were to be divided. In North Carolina, white and colored passengers could not occupy contiguous seats on the same bench. Virginia prohibited the two races from sitting side by side on the same bench unless all other seats were filled. Several states required that the placard saying white or colored be in plain letters not less than 2 inches high. In Houston, The race to which the seat belonged was posted on the back of the seat. In Georgia, the penalty for willfully riding in the wrong seat was a fine of $1,000 or 6 months in prison. Colored passengers were assigned to the front of the rail car on the train, but to the rear of other conveyances to, in the words of the mayor of Birmingham, do away with the disagreeable odors that would necessarily follow the breezes. The bus headed north along the Mississippi River into Arkansas, picking up more people at stops along the way. The seats began to fill. More white passengers than colored seemed to be boarding. They had taken up some of the seats in the very front and were spreading further back. Now, each time new white people got on, they picked up the wooden shingle and inserted it in the seat back where Pershing was sitting. It seemed only the white people could touch the shingle and set the musical chairs in motion. "Go ahead, boy, move on back," the driver told him. Pershing rustled himself up from the seat he was in, gathered his things, looked for an empty space behind him, moved back a row. Sometimes the new passenger took up a whole row by himself, forcing Pershing back, just so the newcomer wouldn't have to sit next to anyone else. At every stop, they had to move again until the colored passengers were now crowded into a few seats in the back, and Pershing found himself in the very last row. It was early summer, and road dust flew into the windows and rushed to the back seat, where Pershing in his brand new tweed suit was pressed among the other colored passengers. The dust coated the tweed and his skin and his hair, and Pershing found it unbearable, packed as he was like livestock. "I was dressed as good as I could be," Pershing said years later, "and I felt very down that I had to submit to this." He looked around him at the other colored passengers to his left and to his right. Grown people, beaten down, hunched in their seats. They dropped their eyes, and he dropped his. "Some have endured, and that's all they've known," Pershing said. "They don't expect anything better, and nobody's demanding anything better. You wouldn't have survived if you had done too much demanding anyway." It was a long ride. There was no toilet on the bus, and the back seats took every bump on the road. Before Pershing could make it to St. Louis, he passed his urine and sat in his soaked tweed pants and felt lower than he had in his entire short life. St. Louis was a blur. Madison carted Pershing all over St. Louis, took him into Homer G. Phillips Hospital, where Madison was a resident, and where the nurses fawned over the cute little brother with the thick eyelashes and waves in his hair. Madison reminded him it was time to get ready for college. For a while, when he was 13 or 14, Pershing actually thought he didn't have to go. He told his mother that one day. "Mama, I'm going to stop school." He didn't realize how impossible that was, his father being principal and all. Audie indulged him. "Baby, why are you going to stop school?"
"I want some of the things the other boys got."
"Like what?"
"Like clothes."
"Well, what do you want?" Pershing couldn't think of much in particular that he didn't already have.
"I want a suit. I want a pair of shoes."
"Now I tell you what you do," his mother said. "You save your little money you get from the milk. Now get you a little job after school or in the summer, and you work and save your money. And when you got half of whatever it cost, I'll give you the other half."
Pershing listened.
"And you don't pay down on anything," she told him. "You can keep your money as well as that white man can."
The nearest college was right in Monroe, across the railroad tracks from where they lived. Northeast Louisiana College had a brand new campus with reasonable fees, built with taxpayer money, to which his parents' meager salaries contributed. Students who looked like Pershing weren't permitted there, so the family debated where Pershing would go. His mother wanted him at Morehouse,
the most prestigious college in the country for colored men. It was in Atlanta, which might as well have been Paris, and she wanted the biggest she could get for her baby.